del mar los vieron llegar. Mis hermanos emplumados eran los hombres barbados de la profecía esperada. Se oyó la voz del monarca de que el Dios había llegado y les abrimos la puerta por temor a lo ignorado. Iban montados en bestias, como demonios del mal, iban con fuego en las manos y cubiertos de metal. Solo el valor de unos cuantos les opuso resistencia y al mirar correr la sangre se llenaron de vergüenza. Porque los dioses ni comen ni gozan con lo robado, y cuando nos dimos cuenta ya todo estaba acabado. Y en ese error entregamos la grandeza del pasado, y en ese error nos quedamos 300 años esclavos. Quedó el maleficio de brindar al extranjero nuestra fe, nuestra cultura, nuestro pan, nuestro dinero. Hoy le seguimos cambiando.
Good afternoon to our listeners here at Voices of Resistance at WBAI 99.5 FM. New York. Today is Sunday, November 7. It's a beautiful day outside. New York is slowly coming back to life. Last weekend we had the Halloween parade, and it was the Halloween weekend. The city came down into a celebration. It was really gorgeous to see all the kids, all the happiness and life coming back to the city. And today, nothing more lively than the New York City Marathon. So all five boroughs connected. We know we didn't have the marathon last year because of COVID. So it's very humbling to be in New York this particular week. And it's also very humbling because my sister Lucy is not here today because she lost her sister. And to her, our love, and to her family. You know, here at Voices of Resistance, we do our best, and we've been trying to fight the system, imperialism, capitalism, and everything that is against basic human dignity. But nothing tells us how much we are human. And on that note, today, you know, it's elections month here in New York. We had elections this week. Terry Matson is joining us. She's going to be my co-host today from Nicaragua, talking about the elections that are happening right now in Nicaragua. And we also have Carlos Javier Estrada talking to us from Argentina about what's happening in Argentina and also in Honduras, because he's part of Partido Libre and one of our funders. We mostly, starting the program, we have Omawali Clay, who is a leader here in New York City, a force to reckon with. But before we bring Omawali in, Terry, hello, how are you?
Hi, hello, everyone. I'm so pleased to be joining the program today. I'm honored that you asked me to co-host with you today, Andrea. I'm very sorry to hear about Lucy's sister, and we send good thoughts to her and her family. And I'm honored that you considered me as a considered me to join you today. So I'm talking to all of you live from Nicaragua. We're in Chantales, and I've been here for a week now, and today I'm serving on an accredited international election team. So we've been observing since 7 a.m., well, before 7, 6:30 a.m. this morning. We're on a lunch break, and we'll go back out to more polling centers this afternoon. But we'll save that.
We'll save that.
I was just like, that's the hook for your listeners to stay in, to stay with us the whole hour.
And we invite our listeners to call us at 212-209-2877. Without further ado, let's bring in Mr. Omawale Clay, who is, as I said, the fortune reckon with. He's a leader here in New York, a founding member of Black Men's Movement Against Crack, which was the first grassroots community price segment against the crack epidemic. He is an organizer of Today's of Outrage Against Police Brutality and Racist Attacks on the Black Community. He is the creator of this law that we say, close the crack house, and one that we always use, no justice, no peace, whose streets, our streets. He's been everywhere, and, you know, he's entered as a director of communication when Africa called, Cuba answered, he was there. He's the director of communications of December 12th movement, a Black human rights NGO consulted with it all. No, he's done a lot more. But Omawale, welcome to our show. How are you?
I'm fine. Very glad to be here as always, and to our hosts. And very sorry to hear about Lucy and her family's loss. Please send our condolences.
I think she might be listening. I'm hoping she is, and she's feeling our collective hug. You know, her sister's name was Gladys Paguada Ulloa, and, you know, she lived in North Carolina, so Lucy now is in this transit, you know, this what I say, this pain of this moment of waiting until you can say your final goodbyes and knowing that you can't say a hello. It's very, very difficult and painful. So Lucy, we are here for you and for your family. So Omawale, we just had elections here in New York and in the country. Two things come to mind. One, in New York City, there were about 21% of people that voted. But the other side of it, there was a lot of Blacks and, you know, ethnic minorities elected, not only in New York, but throughout the country. What do you make of this past November election?
Well, I think a couple of things come to mind. Given the current state of the political economy in the United States, the first thing that comes to mind is a quote by W.E.B. Du Bois, who said, "The United States has one party with two heads." And I think that's so very true and gets pronounced very much in the recent elections. In New York City, in fact, in New York State, we had what would one consider to be a further move towards the right in terms of politics. Certainly we have the election of the second Black mayor, Eric Adams. And on the other hand, we have a number of women city council members coming to office this year. But I think at the same time, one has to look at the question of the national politic, because the national politic controls really the direction of the economy and the real nature of the government in terms of its restrictions and in terms of what it sees important for the people. And in that regard, I think we see this real motion towards the right, further towards the right. And on the one hand, of course, we see the real, agitation around white supremacy in this country, which gets translated, and I think most of your listeners can appreciate, which gets translated as, I think Donald Trump put it, bringing back America, you know, making America great again. And when he gets to that, he's really whipping up the frustration of the population in this country to deal with the nature of the demise of capitalism and how much vicious and predatory it becomes. And so the answer to it doesn't come at the political economy. The answer comes to it by targeting particular groups and nationals as the problem. This motion towards let's go back to the way it was in that regard. And so you see these elections across the country have a real trend once again towards the question of, we're not going forward progressively, we're trying to go further backwards. That's on the one hand, I think, but locally in New York City, and you know, we in the Democratic Caucus would have this view too. You know, when Barack Obama was elected, and there was a tremendous amount of struggle around what will he do, what will he wouldn't do. You know, our position was, whatever's going to go on, it's the people that has to push things in one direction or the other. You know, it's not going to be a particular office holder. It's not going to be some great South's savior who's going to save anybody. It's the people. Barack Obama was a college law professor. In terms of running the government is run by a committee of people who make sure the interests of the ruling class in this country stay in power. And so even in New York City, we have election of the second Black mayor. The first one was Mayor Dinkins. Once again, in terms of running a city, managing the city, I don't think that's the real issue. I think the real issue is, it's another committee to manage the affairs of real estate and banking interests in Wall Street. And so I know there's a lot of discussion around, well, Eric Adams was a policeman and he has that mentality, and absolutely so. But the bottom line is, what Eric Adams is going to do or not going to do is not just simply a question of City Hall. It's a question of us mobilizing, organizing our people. And so as this general trend in the country moves further to the right, you know, and as we always said, Trump was not the cause of it. Trump was just an echo of the frustration, particularly of masses of white people in this country, of what's happening. You know, and our chairperson always says, you know, ignorance can be almost worse than racism, because it doesn't give you a starting point for unity, because people don't want to know anything. They want to stay backwards. They think that the privileges that they have are eroding, not because of the economy, but because, as they say, how it's targeted towards nationals, certainly the Black community, the Latino community, Asian community. That motion becomes an answer for them because they didn't want to go deep. And in fact, let me just say, I think this whole motion in this election, particularly on a national scale around the culture question and how the Republicans have used the issue around schools and this creation of this critical race theory. I'm always fascinated by this. They created this thing called the critical race theory, when actually all that was taking place was a further development of bringing us back to real history, not white history, but history. It's never about Black history. It was about history. And this real fear, particularly from last year's George Floyd motion, that so many young white people were starting to be influenced by the fact that, you know, there's a lot wrong in this country, that people fear that their children are going to be swayed toward this issue of America's not a good place, as opposed to let's be truthful about what America is and what it isn't in that regard. So that fear of the truth, that fear of how it's going to put, position is going to put people in, I think make them move back towards the question of holding on to what they believe, that good old American patriotism, that's good old, let's make America great, regardless of the pain and terror and oppression and exploitation it has been causing since its existence. So this election, I think, is a clarion call to us to continue to do our work even harder. You know, the forces of the right are coming back, but have no illusions, have no illusions that the Democrats and Republicans are trying to hold on to their positions in government for their jobs and for their role to carry out and be members of that managing committee, not to fundamentally change things, but to hold on to the status quo, as one would say. And we find this particularly, I was just reading today about when they were dealing with this question around the infrastructure bill, that the Congressional Black Caucus was one of the key moving points to back up and back off and help them deliver an infrastructure bill that really is not going to have an effect on the real question of unemployment in this country, and then particularly on the question of the oppression of nationalities in this country. In fact, there was another article I just read about the question of the infrastructure bill and its ability to do roads and highways and stuff, which puts it directly in relationship to many of these racist unions. And so it's really like a token to white workers, white middle class, but it's really not dealing with the fundamental question of what's going to happen to oppressed people in this country in terms of their ability to have a decent quality of life. And so the elections, I think, which will continue to be discussed, which continue to be fought for, one of the things I know people were particularly concerned about was in terms of New York City was public housing. And in terms of regards to public housing, you know, there's this whole motion to privatize housing, to literally privatize masses of people's housing that was at least, quote, guaranteed under terms of Section 9 in public housing. And so after decades of letting public housing deteriorate consciously, you know, and deliberately, it was a push towards being able to help private landlords continue to make money off of working poor. And so we were particularly looking at what's going to come out of the infrastructure bill as it relates to rebuilding public housing. You know, there was a lot of talk from Senator Chuck Schumer and Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez that public housing capital improvements in New York City needed to be in the neighborhood of $40 billion in itself, where the infrastructure bill was only talking about $40 billion for the country. And so there was this motion to try to get $80 billion. We'll see where that actually ends up, but it is very critical to masses of people in this country who know that public housing in New York City, if you put all the public housing together, it would be the 31st city in the United States, you know, close to almost 500,000 people in public housing. But the motion to privatize it is a very strong, direct motion that must be beat back at every level, in every borough, in every community, because it's really just a handout to landlords and the banks and stuff. So a lot of these battles will continue. And as for the new mayor has to hear what the people are talking about. And so instead of talking about the mayor, we need to talk about what he needs to be talking about. As not just, he needs to be thinking what we're thinking. And the only way to make that happen is for us to continue to mobilize and continue to stay on point. So, I mean, that's just a few of the comments I had, you know, and hopefully they're helpful in terms of people's thinking and the discussions going on.
Absolutely. You're listening. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM New York. And we are right now talking to Amawali Clay, you know, a political leader here with the December 12th movement. Terry.
I've got a fairly decent Wi-Fi signal here, but I'm sorry if I talk over everybody because I'm not hearing quite every single word. But hi, Amawali. I'm saying hello from Nicaragua on election day here, and I'm happy to be on the air with you again. Listening to your comments about the privatization of public housing really is something that we're seeing across the Americas. And I would argue that it's one of the major clashes between the United States and its economic and political and military system versus some of these other countries throughout the Americas, Nicaragua being one where I am today, where the governments put people over profits, even if they have a capitalist economy. The investment in people and social infrastructure is still there. Whereas, as you mentioned here, specifically New York City, but it is happening across the United States, this push to privatize the last of every public organization, institution, and service that we have left in the United States, to push for 100% privatization and profitability over human beings.
Well, first, how are you? You know, it's always great to talk to you because I know you're always on the front lines, you know. Absolutely. It's one of the great battles. You know, this housing and healthcare are tremendous battles that we have to wage, you know, and on the ground, you know, let me just tell you, on the ground, there was always tremendous effort to deorganize public housing, not to leave it to itself, but to deorganize it. You know, I'm sure everybody looks. You have a tenant association that is funded through NYCHA, the New York City Housing Public Housing Agency. But each building in a NYCHA development is a tenant association in itself, literally. You know, you're talking about buildings that have people almost as much as 10 square blocks of people. And, you know, you have block associations for each block. But in a housing development, you have a tenant association for the whole development. And so the whole infrastructure of housing developments were never designed to mobilize and organize the people themselves. So in these battles that are going on now, probably one of the flip side of the privatization is their ability to get people to sign themselves out of public housing leases and sign themselves into Section 8, which is a windfall for the landlords, giving them market rates for public housing apartments. They've had difficulty in making that happen too, because of a tremendous amount of disorganization in the public housing. However, you can't rest on that, because that's not really a positive thing. People need to be organized. So I think more and more, as housing organizes and more information is coming out every day about this windfall for these private developers. And then these private developers think they're very slick, you know. They sit down with the banks, they sit down and talk about how we can borrow money, fix up the developments, and get people to go to Section 8, where they can get now over $2,000 for a public housing apartment. And they come in and say, we're going to fix everything up and just believe we're going to do it. And sign yourself out of public housing into Section 8 and just believe us. And there's some battles going on now that are very important battles. And for those folks who are listening and know people in public housing who might be in this program that started under the Obama administration called the PAC-RAD program, which is a privatization program, let people know, look into this. Do not sign yourself out of public housing. You know, do not do that, and demand that you get all the information as possible. They're trying to sell this to people. And as you said, Terry, it's across the Western Hemisphere. They're this quiet of privatization of whatever public, you know, and it's not new, you know, it's not a new thing. And so for those of us who've seen this trend historically, you know, when in deep crisis, let's just nationalize and private, you know, under the banner of nationalizing, you're really privatizing, taking things out of the public sector and putting them into private development. You remember the whole big thing, they wanted to do that with the prisons, you know, this privatization. So it's a great concern, and we got to up our game around it, you know, we really do.
Absolutely. And Omawale, one question that I had to you had to do with representation, because, you know, the same United States that's out there trying to destabilize countries like Brazil, Nicaragua, has been doing that to Cuba for over 60 years. The same United States is touting its democracy. And it's democracy that has, you know, like Gus Cahan said, well, I don't know, I wasn't even born yet, you know, 21% of the 26% registered voters are the ones voting. So really, it's a minimal turnout of the registered voters. Yeah, they're saying, oh, we elected Michelle Wu in Boston. We elected Eric Adams. We elected, you know, a public black DA in New York. We elected a black controller in New York. You know, Jermaine Williams is there. Everybody. It's like, so Black Lives Matter is advancing its cause. With this representation that's out there, do you believe that the grassroots movements are supported by the current elected officials, the ones that came out of the ballot on Tuesday?
Well, you know, Assemblyman Charles Barron had raised something very profound. I remember when we were at the African burial ground, when we were at that point at least celebrating the fact that the reparations bill in the New York State Assembly had moved forward and was passed by the Assembly, at least at that point. One of the things he raised, this illusion of Black power, you know, he says we have the head of the New York State Senate is Black. The head of the Assembly is Black. The Attorney General for New York State is Black. And then he went through all the different places that we have Black people, you know, but yet the conditions of our people get worse. And so I think the question around the illusion, and this is why I said I started out saying, Du Bois said that the United States has one party with two heads. The question of being elected to electoral office, the question is, what is the politics? Let's look at Buffalo. Let's look at Buffalo. When the sister up there, India Brown, won the Democratic primary overwhelmingly. But the mayor, the former mayor, the four-term mayor, who was really just a machine candidate, when she won the Democratic primary, the head, I think it's Jacobson, who is the head of the New York State Democratic Party, did not endorse her. And when people asked him why not, he said, if George Duke, the head of the Klan, if he had won the Democratic primary, he wouldn't support him either. Then I have to equate this sister, this working class sister, with the head of the Klan. And so you sit there and look at that and say, so here the mayor comes back. But what did the mayor come back about? He came back in opposition to some real struggle for some at least forward motion in terms of politics. So the machine comes together and supports itself. Whether the person is Black or white, it's the machine itself. And that's why I thought Assemblyman Barron's point was always correct. We look at all of this people in these, what do we say? You know, Black faces at high places. But the bottom line is, how do they truly affect not just the program and the political economy that affects our people, but how they really negatively affect the organizing of our people? They often pimp off of the mass upsurges and agitation in our people, but they are a negative effect on the organizing and mobilization of our people. In fact, usually our mobilization and organization, what it makes them do is say things that they don't even want to say and they don't even want to mean, you know, in that regard. So, I mean, to your point that you would almost think if you just looked at it from a structural point of view, that Black power exists in New York State. I mean, you would really think that, you know. However, it's an illusion.
But you know what? This is to me where our whole crisis with identity politics comes from, because, you know, skin color, ethnic orientation, race, however you want to define it, does not determine whether or not you are a neoliberal. And this is where we get confused in the United States, that just because you appear externally to be something doesn't necessarily define your politics or your economics, as you said earlier. And we trip over that in the United States. We really get, you know, tied up in that.
Well, you know, Terry, let me just say, here's one of the things, you know, there is a national question for Black people in this country. There's a national question that has been a historical question that has gone on, which is principled. You know, the national question or class question, which is principled, you know, which we want to look at first. And so one cannot deny the fundamental question around class in that regard. However, at the same time, one cannot necessarily disregard the national question for our people. You know, almost, in, if you look at it, almost a literal colonization of our community, you know. Mm-hmm. And so the representation of our community is very important. It is very important. I think for Black people, it's the understanding that it's not simply a question of you're Black, but it is more a question of you're Black with what's politic. So I say that only in terms of a shade that it's not just a general question that, you know, hey, it's just their political question. No, that denies the national question for Black people in this country and their historical relationship in this country to its political economy and to democratic rights. You know, so I just want to make that distinction. It's not simply a question that, hey, it's simply just the class question. And, you know, and that's, it's just really what people's politics are. So you know what? You can have some good political people and they can be, and it's okay. They can be all white and they're in charge of a Black community. No, that's not correct. You know, and that's kind of a abstraction of the way things actually exist anyway. But I certainly hear your point that you cannot negate the relationship between the two of those. It's very important to understand that. That's why I said the point that Charles had made and often makes is that Black power is not just having some Black people in a place, but it's exactly. who are they and what is their politic and what is their relationship to other communities in terms of their politics in that regard. You know, I think that's a deeper look at that question.
It's a whole other program. And it's so great that you are here, Omalali and Terry Madison, Omalali Clay and Terry Madison. We have a caller standing by, but we want first to ask our listeners to support WBAI. Free Speech Radio is not free. You can call 212-209-2950, or you can go to give2wbai.org. I'm going to ask Sean to play our song that we are dedicating to Lucy and her family. And I would like for you, Omalali, to stand by because I'm pretty sure the question from the caller has to do with what you're bringing up. And then we are going to bring in Carlos Xavier Estrada. Terry's going to talk a little bit more about what's going on in Nicaragua. And we're bringing Dr. Bood, also from Nicaragua. So, Sean, please go ahead, the song and then the caller.
Mamá la negrita se le sale la peba canita y la negre me sigue ya no sabe quejarse. Drome negrita que yo va a comprar nueva conita que va a tener carcabine que va a tener carcabine. Se tu drome, yo te trago un enemo y calarao. Me seno drome, yo te trago un babalao.
You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM New York. What you just heard was Dormite Negrita, which is a song from the traditional cancionero in Latin America, and that was interpreted by Andy Bay. Caller, please go ahead. You have 1 minute just to state your question because we still have a lot to pack in. Thank you.
Thank you so very much for this wonderful show as always. And I my sympathy goes out to Lucy as well for Gladys, her loss of Gladys, her sister. And also, it's a great honor to ask a question to Omawale Clay, right?
Yes.
Yes, and it's a great honor. And I wanted, my point is that that I believe that people should run a resistance against those people who are now occupying the office, in fact, joining Charles Barron and his wife, joining them so that they're not in the minority. And I wanted to know, I had heard an interview by Arthur Schwartz yesterday, Saturday at noon. His program, by the way, is moving to 7 p.m. on Thursdays. Advocating for Justice is his program. And he interviewed Darlene Mealy, who spoke against Section 8, as you have today, and her idea was to turn the NYSHRA public housing into co-ops in, that are run by community-based organizations. And so I wondered what you thought of her. Also, Cordell Clear was on also. She, both of these people elected, but Darlene Mealy wants, is running to be Speaker of the City Council. And I think she would be great. I heard that interview. It's amazing. She was interviewed from 12 noon yesterday till 12:30. People should listen on the archives. And I wondered what you thought of, do you know Darlene Mealy and Cordell Clear? She also talked about public housing, Cordell Clear. One little thing I want to add about Eric Adams. Nobody has been talking about it. He wants to now get a digital currency for New York City. He's working with the Federal Reserve banks and with the big banks. That man is going to try to get a digital currency that opposes the other currency that they have.
The cryptocurrency. But that's a whole other program. Let me ask Mr. Omawale to answer this in a minute because we still have two other guests to come in. Thank you.
Okay. Very quickly. Certainly, I was very happy to hear and very supportive of Cordell Clear becoming the new state senator for Harlem. I work with her, you know, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for her and her politics. And I wish her well. And I'm sure we'll see each other, as always, on the battle line and the front lines. But on a specific question around, and let me just say, Arthur Schwartz, great attorney, and brought a tremendous amount of information to a number of public housing residents in East New York, where I work. And so very happy about that. In fact, I'm trying to prod him into doing some legal work in that regard. But on the question that you specifically raised about the co-op question, I think one of the things is, and you know, I worked at HPD for a number of years, particularly around community management and that whole process of NREM. And one of the things I think that gets belittled is the question of tenants being able to run their own housing. You know, I know it's always an interesting thing to have community groups come in to do it, but the bottom line is, I know Charles and Inez Barron had pushed for the question of turning public housing into community land trust, where the people who live there and are housed there actually run their own developments. We have some tremendous examples of that. That question of self-determination for them, you know. Public housing is a public trust. And I don't know whether anybody more important to trust the housing with than the people who actually live there in that regard. So if Darlene raised that, and, you know, she's coming back to the city council after a time away, if she raised that, I think the direction is very important. I think the direction is very important. Definitely opposition to Section 8. And so what do you do now? Because they let it deteriorate for decades now. Tremendous deterioration under Bloomberg's 12 years. People right now that can't forget when he put the head of somebody from Lehman Brothers, financier, as the head of NYCHA. And so This is going to be ongoing discussion. My view is to put it into the hands of the people who live there. I don't think it needs a community group. I think the tenants need assistance and they need resources in that regard. But in terms of running it, I think the tenants can create their own structure and infrastructure to run it for the people who come to live in public housing.
Absolutely. We wanted to go ahead. Thank you so much, Omawali, and thank everyone. Mm-hmm. Housing is a whole other conversation, and we want to transition to the original topic, which is elections. And we want to talk about elections in Latin America. At the end of the month, Honduras is having elections. Argentina has been having local elections. Nicaragua is having elections today. So, Mr. Clay, you're welcome to stay with us. But we wanted to bring in our next guest. And Terry, could you please bring him up?
Okay. I'll go right ahead. Thanks very much for having me. And as you know, when you call, I answer.
And we're going to go get you again. Thank you.
We love you.
Take care.
We love you, and we always love what you have to say. It's a pleasure working with you all the time.
Stay safe.
So thank you so much.
Okay. Take care.
Terry?
So I want to introduce our next guest. Our next guest is Carlos Javier Estrada. He's the founder of Government Innovation and Public Policy Lab of Liberty and Refoundation Party. He's currently living in Buenos Aires to finish his political science degree at the University of Buenos Aires. And this is so exciting to have you with us today, Carlos, because Argentina has National Assembly legislative elections on the 14th of November, which is a week from today. We're watching presidential election returns in Nicaragua today, and Argentina on the 14th, Venezuela and Chile on the 21st, and Honduras on the 28th. So we could very well be looking at a very different Latin America by this time next month. So welcome, Carlos. It's an honor to have you on our show.
Thank you very much. For inviting me, for having me here, and I hope to answer all your questions the better way I can.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. First of all, I want to talk to you a little bit about myself. I'm from Tegucigalpa, from the capital of Honduras. Since 2009, I became interested in politics, and this issue led me to study political science. Today, I'm living and studying in Buenos Aires, Argentina, where I have been able to learn more about Latin American processes in these last 8 years. My interest in political science was mainly motivated to contribute to social and political changes in my country. And this is why, the thing is that our society mainly in Central America, it's very conservative. And we come from, a very short-minded middle class where progressive ideas were demonized. But since the coup of 2009, it opened a political Pandora box somehow. And this opened also a social debate on the streets surface, and that's precisely what I managed to get out of my middle class bubble. So this process I've been through Honduras society in general, and the issue is that this is why we have now the Partido Libre, that it's Liberty and Refoundation, which says in English. And the thing is that we have 12 years in a dictatorship that have been helped by the U.S. government in a very cynic way. The thing is that we have been observing a lot of changes during these years. So we really want to think that the U.S. has learned the lesson now according to their foreign policy. our political system it's been co-opted by the elite, the economic elite. So it's more a plutocracy. We're talking about a plutocracy. We don't have a democracy, and this plutocracy have been in power by electoral fraud. So it's really sad, because this fraud, we can say that it's the mirror of this fraud is violence, it's assassination, it's forced migration, violations of human rights in general. So I don't know. It's kind of sad, but at the same time, it motivates a lot of people in Honduras to change this situation. So, what's happening with the other countries are we can compare a lot of things that are happening in many ways.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I wanted you to talk about, bring it back to Honduras, you know, your native country and Lucy's. We are talking about a newly appointed ambassador to Nicaragua, to Honduras, who, not coincidentally, is the ambassador of Nicaragua right now. What I see is a pattern very similar to 2009, where the same ambassador went from Honduras to from Paraguay to Honduras to Brazil, and the coups happened consequently. These people do not want democracy to be in our countries. And, you know, after you talk a little bit about that, I want to bring Terry in so that we can get the next, if you could talk about 2 minutes about that, and then I can bring Terry in to tell us about the situation in Nicaragua.
Okay, and we want to believe that Biden administration learned the lesson now. As you say, they really have this intervention policies in Latin America, specifically here in the case of Honduras. But we want to believe that he's advocating for clean and transparent elections in Honduras, and maybe, just maybe, and I'm gonna laugh a little bit. Just maybe they want to just take control in case the Juan Orlando, the actual dictator, don't wanna really recognize the election. We know that it's kind of nonsense, because Juan Orlando doesn't really have any power or more power than the U.S. So having a nomination like Mrs. I don't remember the name right now, but I think it's Doug. This new ambassador that could be confirmed in the next hours. She used to be the ex ambassador in Nicaragua. So what we are looking there is that they are trying to control whatever happens after the 28th of November. So when I talk about control, we are not pretty sure if they want to control the next government or if they want to avoid the next government, a democratic government. But I just can say that in the end, it's the people in charge of making the new ambassador see that they will no longer be able to sustain a dictatorship of any kind. There's fear. But I believe that Honduran society has matured enough to assert its rights to a democracy.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, and that brings me back to Nicaragua, and we have about 9-7 minutes left in the show. And Terry, we wanted to bring Dr. Bud in, and we're not going to have enough time. But you're there. What can you tell us about what's going on in Nicaragua? What are the projections? What is the turnout? And what is the interference in terms of propaganda and what have you?
Well, I think the propaganda is a big issue, and that's why I wanted Dr. Boot to join us. And he is here, and I think it's really important to share with your audience what we are doing here in Nicaragua this week. Today is presidential election day, And both of us are participating on a six-person accredited international election observation delegation. There's actually about 163 international observers here on the ground today, and 63 journalists, I believe. And so far, we have seen very quiet streets, full polling centers, a lot, very high voter enthusiasm. All of the polling centers we have visited the first part of the day, turnout is equal to prior years and often higher, certainly not lower. It's equal to or better than prior years. One of the things that happened first thing this morning before we even got to a polling center to start observing and reporting was that Dr. Boud discovered that he has been banned from Facebook for 3 days before we even start our, you know, our storytelling from here. And I think that's really important to share with your audience, because we know this big story broke, I think it was Tuesday in the States, about Facebook Meta deplatforming many, many pro-Sandinista Facebook pages and groups. And so I'd like him, Andrea, to just to share with the audience what happened today while we were, you know, before we even started our observation.
Absolutely. Back to Boud, welcome.
Okay. All right. So I'll start by introducing myself. I'm a physician from Halifax, Canada. And I'm working as an election observer here in Nicaragua. I've worked as an election observer in various other countries, including El Salvador, Honduras. And I also worked in Nicaragua during the 1980s, during the Contra War, and also during the 90s. So essentially, I was banned from Facebook after I responded to a post on a certain website called Confidencial. So Confidencial is a right-wing website in Nicaragua that is opposed to the government of Nicaragua, one of many, many such websites. The post was entitled, YouTube Eliminates 82 Sites with Ortega Regime Propaganda. And in the preamble to the article, there was a statement saying the closure of the YouTube channels occurred 2 days after Facebook eliminated, in their words, a cross-government troll farm in Nicaragua. So first of all, I just want to point out the falsehoods in those statements. Number one, it's not a regime. It's a democratic government. They've been elected democratically. It's not propaganda. What they refer to are articles such as the Nicaraguan government opens a new hospital in Chinandega, or the Nicaraguan government opens a new cancer treatment center in León. And secondly, the statement that there's a cross-government troll farm, whatever that means, is also completely false. And I'd like to refer people to a great article published by The Gray Zone, in which they talked about all the people who were banned from Facebook, hundreds of sites, many, many journalists and activists in Nicaragua were banned. These people ran videos explaining who they were and to disprove the idea that they were trolls. These videos were taken down as well. So
who is controlling the propaganda?
So that's right. So the comments that I made that got me banned, essentially, I stated that the United States government used a massive campaign of lies and disinformation to overthrow the government, in an attempt to overthrow the government of Nicaragua in 2018. And I stated that the U.S. is the world's biggest producer of social media disinformation, which they use to overthrow or attempt to overthrow governments around the world. So this is a fact that's been well documented in many incidences of this. I'd like to refer people to a report by the Alliance for Global Justice. On their website, you'll find something called Live from Nicaragua, Uprising or Coup, in which they document how the United States used media outlets such as Confidencial and many, many others in their attempt to overthrow the government in 2018. These websites, these right-wing websites, are dominated by the Nicaraguan oligarchy, and the U.S.-owned social media platforms such as Facebook and Twitter provide platforms for them. Hundreds of young people have been trained by the USAID and NED to work for these sites and to create a dominant narrative, such as essentially the Nicaraguan government is an evil, violent, and oppressive government.
You know,
Go ahead.
We have about less than a minute to go. So,
all right then. Well, then, you know, so basically, this disinformation campaign is once again being used to influence the outcome of the elections today in Nicaragua. This is outside interference in the electoral process of a sovereign country. So, as an election observer, I felt compelled to speak out. And for this, I was censored and banned from Facebook for 3 days.
Which includes election day today.
Absolutely. It is a pattern that happens across Latin America. Brazilian elections were hijacked by Breitbart and Steve Bannon and his allies. They're still running major operation robot centers throughout the world. Unfortunately, we're going to have to do a program, unfortunately, specifically on what social media and fake news is, because we are out of time for today. And again, I want to send my regards and condolences to Lucy and her family. I want to thank our listeners. I want to thank Linda Barr. I want to thank Richard Reimers and our dearest Sean Rhodes for their trust, their confidence in us. Terry, so many thanks for helping me out through this. And be safe out there in Nicaragua. Thank you, Dr. Bood. And thank you, Carlos Javier Estrada. We want you back here, especially when tu presidente becomes elected, when normalcy returns to Honduras. And we hope to see you soon, next Sunday at 1 p.m. Until then, resist.
Soy lo que dejaron, soy toda la sobra de lo que se robaron. Un pueblo escondido en la cima, mi piel es de cuero, por eso aguanta cualquier clima. Soy una fábrica de humo, mano de obra campesina para tu consumo. Frente de frío en el medio del verano, el amor en los tiempos del cólera, mi hermano. El sol que nace y el día que muere, con los mejores atardeceres. Soy el desarrollo en carne viva, un discurso político sin saliva. Las caras más bonitas que he conocido, soy la fotografía de un desaparecido, la sangre.
Good afternoon. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. Voices of Resistance with Lucy Piguada Quesada and Andrea Vizu came to you live over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio WBAI in New York. Coming up at 2 o'clock is La Voz Latina with Daniel Vila. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Julian Joyello, and I'm a listener and supporter of WBAI. I'm a student at NYU, and I live in New York City. And I want to shout out to the other young listeners of WBAI. We have to help keep the station going, and the easiest way to do it is through the WBAI Buddy System. If you donate as little as $10 a month, you have proactively promoted free speech radio. Go to the website WBAI.org, click the donate button, and make a difference.
Extinction Diaries. While the world is caught up with the COVID-19 virus and decompresses from a contentious U.S. election, things in the Arctic have taken an alarming turn for the worse. A record-breaking ice melt led to a refreeze later than ever before, and worse still, the refreeze is failing to solidify on the Siberian side. Most alarming is that no one seems to be talking about it. So let's start. For decades, the science community has warned us that a runaway melt could be triggered if humans do not stop generating greenhouse gases that are heating Earth up. The data each year showed we were failing and should have triggered a global survival response, for the human race is in the balance. We have to face that. It's way past time we all engage. From each of our dinner tables to the very peak of our national infrastructure, economic, manufacturing, transportation, all aspects of human civilization must be quickly transformed to support our survival and not our extinction. To survive, we must save the polar bear's home. If we save the big white bear, humans have a chance. There is no more time. My name is Rising Moon, and this is a Small World Radio production.
We will not bow down to injustice.
Last month here in New York, the International Tribunal on U.S. Human Rights Abuses Against Black, Brown, and Indigenous Peoples, with an esteemed global panel of jurists, was convened by the Spirit of Mandela Coalition. Tune in to Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy program this Monday, November 8th at 4 p.m. to hear highlights of testimony and the verdict. Learn the truth about government involvement in racist police killings, hyper-incarceration, political imprisonment, and systemic environmental and public health racism against Black, Brown, and Indigenous peoples. Again, that's Monday, November 8th at 4 p.m. on COVID, Race, and Democracy here on WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. For more information on the tribunal, go to tribunal2021.com.